Kafka lecture for the Literature in the Modern World. This is the first foreign text, and it's appropriate that in looking at literature in the modern world, we put a foot into a foreign, non-English speaking literary culture. Since the modernism we've been discussing in relation to poetry, and more recently in relation to Joyce's Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, was clearly an international phenomenon. As poets, there are Rilke and Valéry, as well as Eliot and Yeats and William Carlos Williams. Among the novelists, there's Proust and Thomas Mann and André Gide and Kafka, as well as Virginia Woolf, Joyce and Henry Greene. Now, what we find with Kafka, I propose, are some of the central features of modernist fiction in an unusually radical form. These should emerge as I go on. And what I aim to do is to provide a framework for your detailed discussion of Metamorphosis or of any of the other stories in that collection in seminars. What I want to talk about first is the relationship of the modernist writer to his or her audience and to culture in general. To make a generalisation, I would say that it's marked by a distance that is highlighted by the experience that so many of the writers in the first half of the 20th century either chose or had forced upon them the experience of exile. Joyce, for instance, chose it. At the end of Ulysses, there are the names of three cities, Trieste, Zurich, Paris, which indicated his nomadic travels across Europe in the process of writing that novel. So he went into exile, and yet he continued to write about the country and the city that he'd chosen to leave, Ireland, and more specifically Dublin. It was though that Joyce needed that geographical and cultural distance in order to recreate that world in his imagination. You remember at the end of Portrait, the would-be artist and writer Stephen Dedalus chooses silence, exile and cunning. He's very different in this respect from a 19th century novelist with whom, in some ways, he might be compared, Charles Dickens. Dickens, with his closeness to his audience, his need of the London streets. There's a famous anecdote about Dickens that when he was writing Dombey and Son in Switzerland, he exclaimed in a letter that he simply couldn't write there amongst the mountains. He needed streets all around him. He needed the great magic lantern of London in order to get his imagination going. Well, I think Joyce was the opposite. He somehow needed to get away from the streets of Dublin in order to write about them. Now, with other novelists, there's also exile, chosen by some of them or forced upon them. D.H. Lawrence chose exile after the war and spent a peripatetic life wandering around Europe and Mexico and other New Mexico and other places. Other writers had exile forced upon them. Joseph Conrad, another great modernist novelist, was a Polish exile. Vladimir Nabokov was exiled by the Russian Revolution. And the German writers Thomas Mann and Bertolt Brecht were exiled by the rise of Nazism. And even Virginia Woolf, who of course never went into exile but lived always in England, even Virginia Woolf, although she in some ways she lived at the heart of the English literary establishment, did experience a kind of distance in that she suffered the marginal condition of being a woman writer in a literary establishment dominated by men. Now, Kafka too was just such a marginal figure, not because of his gender, of course, but for other reasons. He was not an exile in a literal sense, but a man who, for various reasons, was on the sidelines of the social and cultural world into which he was born. He also compared himself with Dickens and can be seen in relation to Dickens. And what Kafka said of Dickens was that Dickens was all rich and heedless overflowing. And that overflowing element and the heedlessness of Dickens' writing defines the opposite kind of writer to Kafka himself. Well, I mean, and unlike Dickens, Kafka certainly did not have that taproot to popular culture and that finger on the pulse of his audience that Dickens had. Dickens famously, when the sales figures of the installments of Martin Chuzzlewit began to drop off, sent Martin off to America, and the sales then began to pick up. He said, did have, so to speak, his finger on the pulse of his audience. He knew them. He had an intimate connection with them. He was at the centre of his own literary culture. Kafka, by contrast, was a marginal figure. Well, why was he marginal, we may ask? He grew up in Prague, capital now of the Czech Republic, and then, when Kafka was born, capital of the Czech-speaking province of Bohemia, which was then part of that ramshackle, multilingual confederation of peoples in Central Europe that we know as the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Kafka spoke and wrote German, as I'm sure you know, and as a German speaker, he spoke the language of the ruling class of that Austro-Hungarian Empire, but he was at the same time in a linguistic minority in his native city. Only 5% of the population of Prague spoke German as a first language. And within that linguistic minority of 5%, he belonged to another minority because he was Jewish. In adult life, he became more aware of his Jewishness and, inspired by the visit of a Yiddish-speaking theatre group to Prague — Yiddish was the vernacular of the Jews of Central Europe, kind of a mixture of Hebrew and German — He began to learn this vernacular Jewish language, Yiddish, and in his letters he makes occasional comments on language and writing, and one of them he says that the German word for mother, Mutter, doesn't express a Jewish sense of motherhood. It is, he argues, too cold a word to capture all the warmth and richness of what Jews understand by motherhood. Now, what's important about that claim is not whether it has any objective truth, but the subjective sense of distance, estrangement even, that it shows from the one language that Kafka did have command of as a writer, that is German. His Jewishness, in the end, was another thing that made him feel, as it were, marginal, set him at a distance from his own culture. German was the only language he commanded, and Prague German was slightly peculiar insofar as it was the language of a small cut-off population, cut-off, that is, from the main currents of German cultural life. It has been said of the German written by writers from Prague that it tends either to go very florid or very plain. With the case of the poet Rilke, in his early writings it went very florid, lush and neo-romantic, but with Kafka, the German he wrote was very plain. And in one of his comments on writing, he says at one point that metaphors are one of the many things that make him despair about writing. Well, why despair, one might ask? I think there are two senses one can understand that. Following Nietzsche, he probably saw that language doesn't allow you to get to the thing itself. He says, here I am sitting in my room looking at the stove and the cat warming itself beside the stove, and all these things are independent objects existing in their own right. But language is always kind of secondary, always depending upon the cat sitting by the fire, etc. So the language, we can't actually get through to the thing itself. Language always has a kind of secondary character. And the second sense, which I think metaphors were a source of despair for him, was that he had no shared sensibility with his readership, really. There was no common ground between him and the people for whom he was writing. And that sense of a lack of firm ground colours some of his remarks about writing. For instance, quotation 2 on the sheet in front of you. I write other than I speak other than I think other than I ought to think, and so it goes on into the deepest darkness. There is there a sense of a lack of firm ground beneath his feet, the very slipperiness of language. Language is caught up in an infinite regress. Now, the problematic nature of language is a common feature of modernist fiction. We might think of Joyce in contrast to Dickens and David Dickens and his David Copperfield in that respect. Dickens, in David Copperfield, wrote about the portrait of an artist, so to speak. But the writer that David Copperfield becomes is never the focus of Dickens' intention, and we never learn anything about how David acquires the skills of a writer. And it is typical of modernism that language is brought into the foreground, and the problematic language, nature of language, is brought into the foreground, so it occupies a central place in a work like Portrait of the Artists. So Kafka is well aware of the problematic nature of writing, and that awareness feeds itself into the fiction. So Kafka is an oddly estranged and alienated individual. One of his short pieces describes in the first person the experience of standing on a tram and feeling completely uncertain in respect of my position in this world, in this city, in my family. He says, I cannot defend the fact that I am standing on this platform, holding onto this strap and letting myself be borne along by this vehicle. Nobody demands that I should defend myself, but that is neither here nor there. And so there it is, that sense of no firm ground, no justification for his own existence. And he goes on then to describe in detail a girl standing next to him, and wonders how she can simply stand there and not be amazed at herself. A man unable to take his existence for granted, we might think, subjecting it always to anguish scrutiny. And one source of difficulty and anguish in his life was his relationship with his father, who did take his existence for granted in a very uncomplicated way. Kafka's father was a successful self-made businessman, and for Kafka he represents normal life, getting married, settling down, raising a family. Kafka himself kept making overtures in that direction. He gets engaged, but cannot go through with it, as though the embrace of normal life is resisted by some deeper impulse which makes him prefer writing to the kind of life his father would have approved of. He wrote a work called Letter to the Father, which lends itself really to a kind of Freudian analysis. But I would like to mention that only to warn against it. To see his fiction as a working out of an irritable relationship with his father is to reduce it, and it does not get us very far. Does not account for the strangeness of the fiction, its peculiar power and fascination. It's just one way to recuperate this difficult work, and I think it's a way that needs to be resisted. So Kafka does see himself as different from others, but this otherness, this quality of being an outsider, gives him a peculiar perspective on the world. You have to be outside, he seems to imply, in order to see clearly. And there, quotation one on the sheet comes into play. This is a quotation from his diary. Anyone who cannot cope with his life while he is alive needs one hand to ward off a little his despair over his fate. But with his other hand, he can jot down what he sees among the ruins. He sees different and more things than the others. After all, he's dead in his own lifetime and the real survivor. But in a way of generalisation, say that modernist writers seem to be aware that the world, as seen by earlier writers, is the world seen through the spectacles of habit. If you cast off those spectacles, then what you can see can be disturbing. And Kafka indeed sees the intention, the aim of writing, as, in fact, to disturb, to shock us into new insight. Quotation number three. If the book we are reading does not wake us, like a blow from a fist on our skull, why then do we read it? So that it shall make us happy? Good God, we would also be happy if we had no books. And such books as makes us happy, we could, if necessary, write ourselves. But what we need are those books that affect us like a misfortune, that hurts us deeply, like the death of someone we love better than ourselves, like suicide. A book must be the axe for the frozen sea inside us. So, like much modernist art and writing, Kafka's work seems to want to shock us into new insight. And what could be more shocking than to imagine a man transformed into an insect, which is how metamorphosis, of course, begins. Now, I don't want to say too much directly about metamorphosis, but I want to sort of prepare the ground for it. And I would like to look at quotation number 5, which is an example, I think, of the essence of Kafka's writing. Like much of his writing, it's just a little fragment. It's one of those short, seemingly fragmentary pieces in his collected writings, which one might think at first glance must be part of some longer text. But when you look closely at it, you can see that it does have a kind of completeness. Here it is. Give it up, keeps off. It was early in the morning. The streets were clean and deserted. I was going to the railway station. When I compared a tower clock with my watch, I saw that it was much later than I'd thought. I had to hurry. The fright over my discovery made me uncertain about the route. I did not as yet know my way about in this city. Luckily, there was a policeman at hand. I hurried up to him and breathlessly asked him the way. He smiled and said, "Are you asking me to tell you the way?" "Yes," I said, "since I can't find it myself." "Give it up, give it up," he said, and turned on his heel with a flourish, like people who want to be alone with their laughter. As I was saying, here we can see some of the central features of Kafka's fictional world in a few lines. A solitary character in a world that is both ordinary and at the same time ultimately incomprehensible. And this solitary individual comes up against a figure of authority, a policeman, who turns out to be inscrutably remote and unhelpful. The German term that Kafka uses for policeman is Schutzmann. It's an old-fashioned term. And Schutzmann means a protection man, literally, a man who is there for the protection of the citizen, or ought to be. But in this case, just the opposite occurs. Turning breathlessly and rather desperately to the authority figure, the narrator is not guided, aided, or protected, but left even more helpless and lost, as this representative of order rebuffs his plea for help. The ordered world is left in ruins. We might be reminded here of his novels, The Trial and The Castle. Since this is a characteristic configuration in Kafka's world, the hapless figure and facing up to figures of authority who, from whom he can get no sense and who behave in a kind of inscrutable and obstructive manner. But what is also typical, I think, of this little piece is not only the configuration of hapless individual and obstructive and dismissive authority figures, but it is the way that it's narrated. Kafka creates a nightmarish experience in a spare, deadpan way, in a prose that is cool and unexcited, rather than, say, gothic and florid, like the prose of Edgar Allan Poe, who also deals in nightmare experiences, but in the opposite way. But what is characteristic also, I think, is the nature of the narrator here, one who doesn't know what is going on, or exactly, or indeed how to make sense of it. And this isn't simply because he's a first-person narrator. I tend to say he, though there are no grammatical markers that define the narrator as masculine, and gender's not an issue in this story. It could be an individual of either sex, I think. It's not simply because he's a first-person narrator, because much the same is the case in those Kafka stories, the majority, that are narrated in the third person. Now, modernism has been described as involving a crisis of authority. And one thing that is brought into question in modernist fiction is the kind of authoritative narrator that we are used to from our reading of 19th century fiction. Jane Austen and George Eliot, for instance, have just such a kind of authoritative narrator. But in modernist fiction, that authority figure is either not present or undermined in various ways. Now, Kafka dispenses with that kind of narrator to a radical extent. What we find in this fiction is that there is no point of view available in the text from which things make sense. We as readers are left on the same level of incomprehension as the central figures themselves. Thus, this short piece moves from apparent certainty to mystery. It creates a world and, so to speak, demolishes it in the space of a paragraph. Even the final simile doesn't really do what we might expect similes to do, make something clearer by drawing an analogy. It simply deepens the mystery. How do people behave who want to be alone with their laughter? And is the policeman laughing at him or not? The idea is floated, but left hanging uncertainly in the figure of speech. The narrator can't even be certain that he's being mocked, which would at least imply that he's worthy of some reaction. He may just be being ignored, as if his very existence is not worth bothering about. So this short text leaves us with a puzzle, leaves us groping for answers that are neither given nor implied. There are obvious gaps in the pattern of causality. We never know why he panics when he thinks it's later than he believed. And why does he believe the tower clock and not his own watch? Except that this is what Kafka's figures always do. They always believe themselves to be in the wrong. Does he know this town or doesn't he? It seems at the beginning that he knows it. The streets are clean and empty and he's going to the station. There's no implication that this is a strange town to him, but then as the piece goes on, then uncertainty grows. Now, why does he panic when he sees that it's later than he thought it was? I suppose the temptation with such a passage as this is to fill in the gaps. We could create a kind of narrative, more backstory, as people say these days, about a man, for instance, pursued by a criminal gang who's trying to get away before they catch up with him, but it turns out that the police are in their pay as well. That is to assume that it's part of some larger narrative, but of course it's not part of a larger narrative, and there's no evidence in the text to support such a reading. A more persuasive attempt to give the story a meaning might involve reading it as a form of allegory, as about, for instance, the individual in the modern world of impersonal bureaucracy. And if we do this, we might be struck by Kafka's prophetic power, especially when we think of his Jewishness and the fact that two of his sisters died in the Nazi death camps. We might even want to say that in a passage like this, he seems to have foreseen the world of the 20th century police state. And quotation 4 from his notebooks might lead us in that kind of direction, when he says, "I've strongly engaged the negative element of my time, which is very close to me, which I have the right in some measure to represent, if never to counteract." The negative element of his time seems, perhaps in his perceptive way, to lead towards the horrors that are going to engulf European society. So we can read it as a kind of allegory of bureaucratic indifference and the individual's haplessness and hopelessness in the face of some sinister bureaucratic structure. But it could be read on an even more general level as an allegory of man in a godless world where there is no ultimate authority or guidance. So that the policeman stands in for a kind of god figure and then dismisses the hapless individual. Well, it could be read like this, and indeed it might seem to be designed to encourage such a reading, but in the end, there are no firm grounds for any such reading, and this is very characteristic of Kafka's fiction. They often look like allegory, have some of the features of allegory, and tease us towards an allegorical interpretation by making us think that there must be more to this little tale than simply panic and an unhelpful policeman. But equally, they resist such interpretation because they don't emerge from or imply a context of common belief that would be the necessary ground for such an allegory. This is where Kafka's marginal status comes in again. It seems as if he's not writing with any sense of shared cultural values with his audience, and we need some sort of shared common ground for the possibility of allegory. So Metamorphosis seems to be a text of this kind, teasing us towards allegorical interpretation, but not really providing any clear evidence for such a reading. It takes the notion of exile and imagines an ultimate form of that condition by conceiving of a man turned into an instinct. I mean, well, what can we make of this transformation, this metamorphosis, which is at the centre of the tale? Can we read this as a text that takes a simile or metaphor literally? Gregor, we might say, has led an insect-like life, working his socks off as a commercial traveller to support his family and keeping with his superiors in the firm. And what the tale does, we might say, in surreal fashion, is to imagine that simile as a reality. He's led an insect-like life and he gets turned into an insect. But we might think that there's a problem with this. There seems to be a degree of imaginative excess here if what Kafka is trying to do is throw light on the disabling effect of a grinding petty bourgeois existence, the grim life of a wage slave. To imagine a man as an insect is to take the story into a totally different realm from social realism. The story of Gregor may have some resonance with the world of our common experience, with, for example, the ways in which a family might react to having a chronic invalid in their midst. But to read it as an allegory of petty bourgeois existence or of terminal illness is to ignore that degree of imaginative excess that I've referred to. It is so absurd, the notion of man turned into instinct, that it seems to be in excess of anything that could be used as an allegory. Once again, this story invites, but resists, I think, allegorical interpretation. Now, we might note that the way in which the story at the very outset suggests and immediately rejects the most obvious way of recuperating or making sense of Gregor's experience. As Gregor Samsa awoke one morning from uneasy dreams, he found himself transformed in his bed into a giant insect. He was lying on his hard, as it were, armour-plated back, and when he lifted his head a little, he could see his dome-like brown belly divided into stiff arched segments on top of which the bed quilt could hardly keep in position and was about to slide off completely. His numerous legs, which were pitifully thin compared to the rest of his bulk, waved helplessly before his eyes. "What has happened to me?" he thought. "It was no dream." We're told, then, it was no dream. And then the passage carries on to give us the kind of details, rain on the window panes, for instance, that create the effect of the real. And then in and then there's the picture in the room, which is another such a detail that creates the effect of a random detail of an ordinary life. But here it seems to get particularly highlighted. Above the table, on which a collection of cloth samples was unpacked and spread out, because Samson was a commercial traveller, hung the picture which he'd recently cut out of an illustrated magazine and put into a pretty gilt frame. It showed a lady with a fur cap on and a fur stole sitting upright and holding out to the spectator a huge fur muff into which the whole of her forearm had vanished. Later in the story, of course, it's the one bit of furniture that Gregor wants to keep and manages to keep in his room. And it seems, this little detail, which is so highlighted, seems to suggest some larger significance. But I take this to be a characteristic Kafka tease. It's in miniature what the whole story does. It invites us to attach meaning to it, to interpret it, but ultimately resists any interpretation. And that first page ends by implying another such teasing connection between his bodily aches and multiple struggling legs on the one hand, and his exhausting job as a commercial traveller. He tried at least 100 times shutting his eyes to keep from seeing his struggling legs, and only desisted when he began to feel in his side a faint dull ache he'd never experienced before. Oh God, he thought, what an exhausting job I picked on, travelling about day in, day out. So it's not so much the allegorical meanings that turning a man into an insect creates, as the striking and extraordinary effects that it gives rise to. And one of the signal effects comes from the fact that the story not only imagines this bizarre, this absurd physical transformation, but it also retains Gregor's rational human intelligence, trying to make sense of it. This is quotation 7. When after a repetition of the same efforts he lay in his former position again, sighing, and watched his little legs struggling against each other more wildly than ever, if that were possible, and saw no way of bringing any order into this arbitrary confusion, he told himself again that it was impossible to stay in bed, and that the most sensible course was to risk everything for the smallest hope of getting away from it. At the same time, he did not forget, meanwhile, to remind himself that cool reflection, the coolest possible, was much better than desperate resolves. So, cool reflection, the coolest possible. So there is the combination here of an extraordinary, absurd, surreal transformation, and at the same time, a rational mind trying to make sense of it. But of course, such cool reflection doesn't get you anywhere, doesn't get him anywhere, and we might extend that to the reader, it doesn't get us anywhere really. There's no rational remedy for being turned into an insect. We are brought up against the limits of the reasoning mind, against something impossibly absurd. And the tension between the intellect and the monstrous physical absurdity is what animates the story and holds our attention. Now, there's one other effect that I want to comment on, and I want to comment on it in relation to Thomas Mann's, another German writer, Thomas Mann's remarks about a modernist novel, Joseph Conrad's The Secret Agent, where on the basis of discussing that novel, Thomas Mann, the great German novelist, made some general remarks about modern art, which I think are pertinent to Kafka's writing and to a work like Metamorphosis. This is what Mann says. He says that modern art has ceased to recognise the conventional distinctions between tragedy and comedy. Modern art is tragicomic, and the grotesque is its characteristic style. The grotesque, well, I think transforming a man transformed into an insect, and that description of his little struggling legs and at the beginning of the story is an example of the grotesque. And the nature of this grotesque, as Mann puts it, is somehow tragicomic. It merges tragedy with comedy in a peculiar way, so that the comedy robs the potentially tragic subject of its dignity, while the tragedy drains all laughter from the comedy. So we are left with something uneasily and disconcertingly suspended between the two, It's not really funny, except in a very black way. And it's not really tragic, because it is, in an odd kind of way, slightly blackly comical. You might find something of this, of course, in, for instance, the dramas of Samuel Beckett, Endgame, and Waiting for Godot, where there's a similar combination of the tragic and the comedy, and the effect is one which is not exactly tragic, because the dramas have none of the dignity of tragedy. It's not exactly comic either, because you don't actually fall about laughing as you watch a Beckett play. So I think Kafka's writing fits very much into that kind of definition of modern art as tragicomic, and its typical style is the grotesque, the tragicomic grotesque. The grotesque that generates only a kind of mirthless laugh or a wry pity. And on that note, I shall end.